from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Those are the cries of Central American children in a U.S. immigration facility after being separated from their parents from a recording posted by ProPublica yesterday. As the Trump administration continues to carry out its zero-tolerance policy, we'll look at U.S. asylum law and how it applies at the border. Then at 9:30, we get the latest on the U.S. trade battles with China and how President Trump's new threat to impose tariffs on a further $200 billion of Chinese goods could have impact on the U.S. economy. It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, President Trump and top officials, including Homeland Security Chief Kirstjen Nielsen, continued to defend the administration's controversial zero-tolerance border policy, saying that it will remain in place until Congress passes an immigration bill. The policy, which has resulted in the separation of thousands of immigrant children from their families, directs federal agents to prosecute all illegal border crossers, even when they present themselves for asylum. In this segment, we'll look at what happens to immigrants who arrive at the border seeking asylum, what it takes to prove a claim, and the Justice Department's recent directive that gang and domestic violence should no longer constitute grounds for asylum. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about how the U.S. asylum process works? Joining us here in studio, and we welcome back to the program, to the forum program, is Deep Gularesak. I'm sorry. You know, I said his name before we went on the air, and I said, do I have it right? His thumb went up, and here I am stumbling again. But Gulase Karum. I got it that time, didn't I?
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Yeah, glad to have you. And he's professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law. He teaches constitutional law there and immigration law and is co-author of The New Immigration Federalism. Let's go back a little historically because a lot of people have been bringing up analogies to the Nazis, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who was on Fox News, said that analogy doesn't work because – well, the Jews were held and those gypsies and others in Germany and were not necessarily released. But, of course, there was a – we'll talk about this in the next hour, perhaps – a ship going to Miami and it had to be sent back. This whole idea of asylum here in the United States and refugees has its roots there historically, I mean, with respect to Nazi Germany.
Certainly the outrage over what was happening in World War II and the treatment of Jews, the inability to have the non-existence of any real policy of the United States to systemically deal with that crisis is what spurred the significant international protections that were also adopted into United States law after World War II.
But we didn't get to statutory policy until 1980. So help us understand how that evolved.
Sure. So before 1980, a lot of this was done through executive decision-making with regards to the acceptance of refugees in accordance with international treaties and laws to which the United States was party. In 1980, the United States Congress codified this into the Refugee Act of 1980, essentially codifying those, the conventions, the international conventions. And essentially what it provided for was that the United States, as with all signatory countries, had an obligation not to return people to places where they were going to face persecution.
And the asylum differences, and these differences still exist legally, if I'm not mistaken, were seeking asylum for, well, with unlawful entrance versus showing up to ask for it, right?
Well, if just to go back just one stop, no matter who is asking for protection in the United States, they have to meet the same standard. And that is they have to show that they have a well-founded fear of persecution on account of five particular categories. And that is they have to show that they might be persecuted on the basis of race, religion, national origin, their political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. And that is the same whether somebody is presenting themselves for asylum or whether they are...
Whether they're crossed illegally.
Exactly. Yeah. And then they're in deportation proceedings.
And this first goes before an immigration officer, and then it winds up in a hearing.
If somebody is coming to the border and either presenting themselves at the border for asylum, or they're apprehended near the border and to put into proceedings. If they claim that they have a credible fear, they have a fear of going back, then the first step is that they are going to be interviewed by an asylum, by an officer, an immigration officer, to see if they have what's known as credible fear. This is not an asylum determination. It is an initial determination to see whether a full asylum hearing is merited.
But these border crossing agents have a good deal of discretion.
Have a significant deal of discretion. This interview, this credible fear interview, is roughly usually around an hour to 2 hour interview. And if there is a negative determination, that is the determination is this person doesn't have a credible, doesn't have credible fear, it is very difficult for the non-citizen to then challenge or overturn that ruling.
And now we find that asylum cannot be based, they've codified the law even more, on fear of gangs or domestic violence?
This is an extraordinary step taken by the Attorney General. For several years now, there has been established precedent by the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is established in a case of matter of ARCG in 2014, that domestic violence and people who've been the subject of domestic violence can make lawful asylum claims that can be successful in the United States. Recently, the Attorney General took the extraordinary step of certifying a case to himself in a case called Matter of AB and decided that domestic violence is likely not going to be the basis for an asylum claim, and then added a footnote that said neither can people running from gang activity as well.
That's a major change from previous administrations, isn't it?
It is. Prior to this, administrations had been allowing the court system, the immigration court system and the BIA system to go along, and many of those rulings were heading in the direction of establishing that both gang running from gang violence and domestic violence could be the basis of asylum. And as I said, in 2014, the Board of Immigration Appeals had a precedential decision that was binding on courts that allowed them to accept this as a basis for asylum. This is a major change that the Attorney General has implemented, and it's working hand in hand right now with the separation of families at the border to make sure that nobody is given their fair right to claim asylum in the United States.
But in all fairness, when people make those claims, they're hard to prove. A lot of people want to get into this country for economic reasons, and they'll say they're being forced out because of gang violence, or they're being forced out because of domestic violence. I mean, it's very hard for one person in a subjective way to determine that, and yet that would rest on that person's shoulders.
Well, initially, that is why we have the process for asylum determination. It is not a simple process. It's not an easy process. We have the United States trains experts in asking questions and interviewing people to make sure that these are bona fide claims. I would also point out that it is not inconsistent for somebody to be running from economic strife and deprivation and have credible claims of running from gang violence, running from other types of private violence and domestic violence as well. And so these claims often go hand in hand.
Would you agree with the New Yorker article, which advanced the thesis that the Trump administration is just completely unraveling a system of laws and policies that were on the books?
I don't think there's any question that this administration has a view of immigrants and immigration that hews very closely to a closed country as using every single legal lever and illegal lever within its power to make sure that there is no immigration, and especially no immigration from countries that they deem to be where they think the stock of people coming are inferior.
And what about the constitutionality of treating illegal entry as a felony, separating families, which the ACLU is going after now?
So want to think about two different things. It is under our current laws, it is part of our law that illegal entry can be charged as a misdemeanor. It is also true that illegal re-entry can be charged as a federal felony. Despite the fact that these have been a part of law, most in the past administrations have generally sought not to prosecute those immigration crimes, and at least not to prosecute them as it pertains to families coming across the border. What the Trump administration has done is to take the very conscious policy choice to ensure that all people coming are charged underneath those misdemeanors or those felonies. And because of that, children are going to be separated from their families.
Having a conversation with Professor Deep Gulasekaram of Santa Clara University School of Law, And I know there are many of you who have questions about the whole asylum process, and that's really what we're trying to define here. And we do want your response, and we also want to hear from you with any questions or comments you might have. So let me tell you how you can join the program right now. Toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join us, and you can do that now, as I said, at 866-733-6786. You can also let us know your thoughts or any questions you might have by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post them there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. What about Senator Ted Cruz saying that if you put someone in jail and separate them from their families, this is what's done all the time. Prisoners are actually put in jail in the United States who are American citizens, and they're separated from their families. What about that argument?
It's not untrue that when somebody is subject to criminal processes and they are detained, let's say after they're arrested, there is, of course, the practical issue that they might be separated from their family. That is all true. What is happening at the border, though, is of a magnitude and has consequences that go far beyond that. And here's reason why. Families are coming across, and if they're prosecuted, let's say, for the misdemeanor of illegal entry into the United States, that's a fairly quick process for which they're going to get, they're going to be in front of a magistrate. And the potential sentence for this might be time served. It might be a few days, at most a few weeks. What's happening right now is even despite that, even after that's over, families are not being reunited with their children. The children might be moved hundreds of miles away. They're simply not being then put back with their parents after that.
Joseph wants to know, how does the type of entry, lawful versus unlawful, affect an asylum application now?
In theory, it should not affect an asylum application. The difference really is that somebody who presents themselves lawfully at the border and presents themselves as an asylum seeker is in fact doing exactly what the Attorney General suggests that they should be doing. It is in accordance with the United States law. If somebody attempts to unlawfully enter the United States and then claims that they want to seek asylum, they could technically be prosecuted first for the illegal entry and then would still have to have their asylum claim heard, and it would still be the same standard for assessing whether they are eligible for asylum.
Getting a lot of questions as we anticipated. Let me go to a few more that are coming in on email, and then we'll go to our callers. Ford wants to know, could you please explain how the U.S. system compares to that of Mexico?
I am not an expert on Mexican immigration systems. I will tell you that
it's tougher to get in there, though, before this administration, or was.
Well, I will say in the last few years, and really in response to United States pressure, Mexico itself has stepped up its own screening of migrants coming from the so-called Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and has stepped up its own deportations of people coming from those countries.
Well, Kristen Nielsen of Health and Human Services has been saying that they can apply at port of entry. Many are turned away at port of entry. Many are turned away probably as we're speaking now.
That's right. I mean, this is exactly the administration keeps saying people should do this the right way. Well, the right way is to present yourself at a port of entry and to claim that one has a credible fear of returning. People are doing that, and yet as people are doing that, the administration is either not processing them, telling them that they're full, or in the case of the woman who is the plaintiff in the ACLU suit on this matter, their children were still taken away from them and not returned for 4 months.
Yeah, a slight editorial comment, although many people are saying this, it's as if the administration is talking out of both sides of their mouth, on the one hand expressing concern for children, and on the other hand having this deterrence policy, as they call it, making those crossing over felons. Also, I'd like to get your thoughts, Deep, about the fact that there is I want to go to our phone calls first. Let me get another comment in here first, actually. Somebody wants to know if you can define for us perhaps the difference between how the type of entry actually lawful. I'm sorry. What's the difference between asylum seekers and refugees? What's the difference between an immigrant and an alien?
So the difference between an asylum seeker and a refugee really has to do with location. The standard for assessing whether somebody gets refugee status or asylum status is exactly the same as I mentioned to you. They have to show that they have a fear of being persecuted on account of race, religion, national origin, political opinion, or membership in a particular group. What I mean by the difference is location is that refugees are processed in foreign countries outside the borders of the United States. An asylum seeker is processed in the United States, or that's where their hearing is going to take place, either an asylum office or in a removal proceeding at the border or elsewhere in the United States.
Is there any plan that you know of to any protocols in place or anything to reconnect these families or to actually keep track of where they're going and where they are and so forth?
I think what we're finding is that it's a very haphazard process. This has never been done at this magnitude in this way before. And so in many ways, the administration, I don't think the administration itself knows how to do this humanely, certainly. And if you look at some of the claims that are being made, the testimonials, the affidavits, the litigation, it's clear that children are being separated from their families much longer than they need to be. They're being separated even after the parents have served time for, let's say, their illegal entry or illegal reentry conviction.
I think there's no protocols actually for keeping track of them concurrently or keeping parents and children in contact with one another while they're separated or even for reuniting them.
Yeah, so certainly there have been reports that the children in some of these centers run by Department of Health and Human Services, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, get to make phone calls. I've heard media reports that twice a week they get a 10-minute phone call. Sometimes they have trouble reaching their parent during that time. Sometimes they don't know where their parent is during that time, because that requires significant coordination between Border Patrol officials on the one hand and Office of Refugee Resettlement folks on the other hand, who have very different priorities, very different incentives. And so a lot of this is haphazard. A lot of this is not happening. And this contributes, I think, to the psychological harm to the children and the feelings of separation and anxiety.
They both claim, of course, that they don't have enough personnel, too. So that's part of the whole problem. Let me get our callers on here. Let's begin. Allison, with you. You're on the air. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Thanks. I have a question. The Attorney General's opinion talks about private violence not being a basis for asylum. I'm wondering if your expert thinks that will be expanded to include, for example, gay men and lesbians who are fleeing anti-gay persecution in countries with a specific law on the books about that.
Thank you for the question. So this gets to some of the difficulties. Your question gets to some of the difficulties with the question of domestic violence and gang violence and asylum. And that is that the perpetrator in those circumstances is very rarely going to be the government as the government. It's likely going to be a private individual. So what asylum law had been evolving to tell us in the underlying case law was that when it's a private party, one can still win in an asylum claim if you can show that the foreign government or the government in that area was unwilling or unable to control that private violence or to somehow stop it. And therefore, this person, even though it was private violence, was still going to be subject to it and the state was unable to do something about it. As you point out, that idea of private violence can seep into other areas as well, including violence against LGBT folks. And again, that is a significant area of concern. So yes, I think the Attorney General's ruling that takes away the basis of the claims for domestic violence victims and for victims of gang violence can have repercussions and can have effects for people affected by other types of private violence.
Yeah, I'm looking at a tweet from a listener who wants to know if the ethnic breakdown of people coming across the border is overwhelmingly non-white people and if this could be kind of an ethnic cleansing.
I don't think there's any question that when you're looking at the southern border of the United States, you are looking at people primarily coming from Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. I think it's fairly clear from the rhetoric that the administration has used. Donald Trump, of course, calling many of the people coming over as rapists, criminals, not their best people. You have him doubling down on the statement about gang members being animals, a form of dehumanization in the rhetoric used to describe an entire class of people. The number of gang members that actually cross into the United States and are intent on doing us harm, I would say, first of all, the United States already has laws that attempt to control for that. But the picture that Trump and Sessions have painted is sort of this lawless hellscape where these migrants are coming in with the sole purpose of doing us harm couldn't be further from the truth.
Let me get another caller aboard here, and that's Jason from San Francisco. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, my you know, comment and question here. You know, it sounds, as an outsider, it sounds like the Trump administration is really enforcing many laws that were put into place long ago by Congress and others. So just a comment, it seems like the media is kind of taking this out of proportion as these folks are just enforcing the law. My question is, you know, as an undocumented person, if I were to try to go sneak into Canada or another country in the EU, what would happen in that case? I mean, are we being out of line in the way we're doing things, or do other countries handle this in a similar way?
Well, again, I'm not an expert in the immigration laws of countries outside the United States. I will say that the United States faces some unique pressures. The border between the United States and Mexico is the longest contiguous border between two states that have that significant of a difference in their median wages between the two countries. So it's one of the largest gaps in economic development and wage differential for two contiguous countries. There's also historic relationship between the United States and countries south of its border, both in terms of geography and in terms of labor needs and agricultural needs in the United States. So this causes significant pressure at that southern border. To your first comment, it is true that there are statutes that might allow, arguably, room for the Trump administration to be doing what it's doing. That said, I would make two points that are worth considering. One, despite the fact that this authority might have existed, no prior administration has thought that this was a useful policy to pursue or even a humane policy to pursue. Second, that there are constitutional limits to our laws and statutes. And here, when you separate families and children from their families, you are violating some basic tenets of the Constitution, including long-held principles of family unity and family integrity. A district court judge in the Southern District of California and the San Diego sector essentially hinted as much in a ruling from last week.
Actually, one of the listeners raising a question about whether or not you could take Donald Trump and Kristen Nielsen and put them in front of the Hague, since this is supposedly separating children, that is, from their parents against international human rights law.
It is certainly, if you look at international conventions and treaties, they tell you that children need to be protected. They also tell you that people who are seeking asylum should not be criminalized. Both of those things are things that the Trump administration is currently involved in.
Okay, we wanted to do this with listener questions, and so we're going to extend this about 10 minutes, if that's okay with you, Deep. We'll keep you here.
Happy to be here.
All right, and we are coming up on a break. One more question from a listener. Of those detained so far, I was thinking maybe we get another call in here, but if you have a question, please feel free to call us. We're coming up on a break here, and normally we would shift into talking about tariffs, but we're going to do that after about 10 more minutes because I know there are many questions about asylum law, and we have an expert here to answer them. So please feel free to join the program at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.